there we go. Well, good morning. I really don't like pulpits. So if you want to see better than me wiggling around, just, you know, wiggle around and I'll take the hint and move up. But anyway, thanks for having me come. I must admit to being a little bit nervous. Most of the time when I'm talking or I'm presenting, it's to much smaller groups. And they're usually very highly saturated in people that I know. That makes it a whole lot easier to make a fool out of yourself. So my wife often says that I should come with a warning label because we're never really quite sure what's going to come out of my mouth. And that's most of the time because I don't really know. We don't have any slides. I didn't bring any pictures. As I was in your place growing up, watching... Okay, I got my hint. Okay. As I was there watching missionaries come and present, you know, you sit there and, I don't know, maybe you don't, but I do, and you think to yourself, man, I wouldn't do that, or I'd present that this way, or blah, blah, blah. And one of my, I don't know if I'd call it a pet peeve, but, you know, sometimes you show up with these slideshows and all this stuff that maybe not unintentionally, but it provides this emotional response. You know, we get excited about what's happening. We feel sorry for the babies, and emotionally we make a commitment to do something about it. Or I was at a concert one time, and a big drive of the concert was this sponsorship drive, and they've got all these handouts with the pictures of the kids that you get to adopt. And that's all great stuff, you know, a ton of that stuff went out. But as I was talking to the guys afterwards, 10 to 20% of those people actually follow up. And so I kind of want to avoid that sort of thing. And as I was putting together my slideshow, I realized I was exactly building the thing that I didn't want to do. So I scrapped it. And so what I hope to do is inspire you to answer a call, any call, really, because I think a disservice that those of us in ministry can do for people is to try to laminate our calling on you. I think our job as ministers is to help each person become the part of the body or the Christian that God created you to be. Because we don't need, trust me, my family and my wife and all my friends would vouch for the fact that we don't need 250 more Jasons running around. One at a time is plenty. So just a little bit real quick about me. I take notes. Not entirely sure why, because I often just abandon them. But God called me into the ministry in 2007. And since that time, I've done training, and I've served an internship, and I've done this and done that, and had all these great ideas of what I was going to do. And standing here today, it looks nothing like that. But I'm actually with a ministry called Ministry at Large, and it's exactly what it says. What we do is focus on the Great Commission and make disciples. And the way that we do that is get together and go do stuff. I don't know. Different kinds of stuff. Whatever it is. The idea was always, as we encountered groups of men, they would have this idea, and we would go do that and help them do it and raise up disciples along the way. And about the time I was ready to give up on that, because it seemed like nobody really knew what they wanted to do. We want to get together and we'll talk about it, but we're not really sure what we're going to do. And see, I'm kind of a doer. I'll figure it out along the way. If you need a plan, you got to hire somebody else. So after 12 years in the Corps, I quickly realized that plans are for officers, executions for NCOs, and who knows where the plan went when we hit the field. But so I was about ready to pull chocks on that deal, and I got a call to go help with a construction project in Haiti. Actually, I got a call to find out if my daughter could go to Haiti and work on help with this project. And I'm like, no, I'm out. It's not happening. You're not sending my daughter to Haiti. See, I remember the 90s. I got the call when we were going to land troops in Haiti during all the riots in order to help restore civil unrest. This is pre-earthquake, pre-hurricane Haiti. So in my mind, it's got to be worse now than it was then. And the answer was just plain old nope, not happening. And then God in his, you know, infinite wisdom and way of working things out went to work on me. And so I called back up and I'm like, okay, I got a plan. She can go, but I'm going too. Because I'm not turning my daughter over to anybody in a place like that. And yeah, no, that wasn't going to work out either. So a few days go by, I make another call and I'm like, okay, I surrender. Yeah, I will turn my daughter over to the Lord. And if that's where she needs to go to work, then so be it. She can go there because in theory, this is who I've raised her to be, right? Sounds good on paper until time comes to let her go. Well, then when I make that phone call, I get this, well, she can't really go. And I'm like, what? I've lost all this sleep so that she can't go? Like, no, but if you're willing to go, we'll use you. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. So blah, 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 long story short, next thing I know, I'm in Haiti roofing a building for an orphanage. And it was a good deal because I kind of got a bird's eye view, so to speak, on everything that was going on there. And so at first it looked like, you know, typical kind of organization. You know, you look through the brochure and the pamphlets and the website, and even if you look at the picture on the front of the bulletin, kind of looks like paradise. Looks like somewhere where you might go on vacation. And so I'm kind of, you know, doing my thing and picking on the whole program. And then I got to watching what was actually taking place. Because when I first landed in Haiti, I was actually shocked by the devastation that I'd still seen. And we had to take a kind of a Land Rover four-wheel drive type vehicle through town. They hired security to ride with us as we're going through Port-au-Prince, headed up into the mountains. And there's shops and everything. Has anybody been? Been? Okay. It's kind of turning into a popular deal, so a lot of people have been. But there's shops just in random spots. You know, there's a guy with a booth full of used shoes, another guy with a booth full of paintings and trinkets, and they're just lining the sidewalk. And then all of a sudden you find a compressor on the side of the road with a guy that's fixing flats for a living, and he's wired his compressor directly into the overline wire. I mean, it's mind-blowing. And so we progress up into the mountains, and pretty soon we turn off the main road and head up what looked like a canyon. And that was actually the road. Both sides of the road, as you got in there, progressively got deeper and deeper. And at one point, I think the sides were about 20 feet tall. There's boulders and everything all over the place, and we're weaving in and out. There's not enough room for two-lane traffic. Motorcycles everywhere, like ants. And they just bolt in and out, so the driver's honking and carrying on. Kids walking everywhere, climb up the sides of this cliff to let the vehicle pass and then come back down. And what had happened is, well, the first version of the story we got was the levee broke during the hurricane. And so I'm thinking levee, like we have a levee. Now it's nothing like that. It was kind of the natural erosion berm that had built up from the mountain drainage and redirected a lot of the river flow We got creeks bigger than that in Oklahoma. And so when the rains came from the hurricane, that river had overflown. Its newly chosen path had washed out that erosion dam, and the old road came in by the ditch that was kind of the creek. It's all diverted water, and it's their main source for using water and livestock water. And so, you know, that's the easiest route for the water to take, right? And now it's become a road, so it's really the easiest route for the water to take. So this massive wall of water washed the road out, and it ran for days. And a lot of the walls along the way had collapsed and fallen into the road. Some organization years ago had come in and laid a cobblestone in the ditch to help the water flow better. Most of that was busted and broken out. And so there's just this trickly stream running down through there where everybody's kind of getting their water now. And then we head on past all this, and then we get to our compound. Everything over there, or a lot of stuff over there, is behind walls. There's bars on all the windows. You look at the walls, and one of the things you notice is the walls are covered in broken glass or metal spikes or just whatever, just to make them harder to climb over. I mean, it really is. It's kind of mind-blowing. So we get into our compound where the orphanage is, and it kind of turns into a little bit of a resort, to be honest. Everything's well taken care of, very clean, manicured up, and they had these guest houses set up for us to stay in. And at first I was like, it seems a little excessive. I was expecting to live in tarp huts, like the people that were coming here to serve. But we carried on about our work. And I watched the people come and go, and I kept hearing somebody being referred to as mommy. And then I kind of figured out that there are a lot of times there in these rural communities, there would be kind of a family that oversees most things. They're kind of the controlling family, a bit of a matriarch, if you will. And that's what mommy was. And so as I kind of find out how things happen, all of this land that we were crossing from the time we pulled off the main road had actually belonged to her family for generations. So this whole community of Lamadel was actually built on most of the property that mommy and her family had owned. So Village of Vision is a grassroots, locally grown ministry in Haiti. Mommy and her husband, which I still haven't gotten a name on him that I can pronounce, actually started it back in the 70s as a small orphanage. And these guys, they really understand God's understanding, as I get it, of what an orphan is. Because when we think about orphans, we think of small children or under the age of 18. And I don't think God sees it that way. As I was going through, and I got a bunch of scripture references as long as my arm, and it being orphanage months, you're going to hear all that stuff in the weeks to come, so I'm going to skip it. But orphans are the fatherless, people that don't have anybody to guide them, teach them any better, provide for them, give them a trade, just generally make sure they're taken care of. And so this family literally adopted a community. And this last trip up there, I am the only visitor that they had that just took off walking out into the community, outside the walls. Nobody ever leaves the walls. So it really kind of blew everybody's mind that I just bailed out there. And, you know, I went with somebody. I wasn't entirely by myself. My wife's like, this is the first time I've heard this version of the story. But as we're walking along, there's all these farm plots, and then there's these little shops, and there's houses everywhere. And we walked around, and Patricia is a mommy's granddaughter. So I was actually walking the countryside with a local and her kids. And as we were walking by one farm in particular, really caught my eye, because these three kids are sitting on a furrow, just pretty as you please, just planted there. I mean, they didn't move. I've been watching this guy and these kids for walking the better part of a mile, and they're just sitting there, and he's working away. And Patricia says, man, I feel sorry for those kids. I'm like, well, why is that? And they're like, well, they've probably been sitting there all day. When you see that, their mother is off doing something else, so they have to go to the field with their father and sit there. And, I mean, I don't know, any of your guys' kids sit for hours like that and wait? Mine sure won't. Mine would be in the next parish. But, so I watched him. When we got there, I had Patricia ask him if I could give his kids some chocolate. And so he lets me give him some chocolate, and that was all good. And there's a cake that we eat while we're there, and it's only in season, and you eat it a lot for breakfast. It's great, but it's not really bread. It's this pulped-up root that they press into a cake and then dry it in the sun, and they're delicious. My favorite meal while I'm there. But anyway, I was kind of wanting to taste this fruit that this is made out of. I've come to find out it was a root. And Patricia had asked this farmer, he had one of the plants growing in his field, and had asked him if we could, you know, pick a piece of the root off the side of that. And this guy runs over and pulls the whole plant and runs it back over and is trying to give it to Patricia. And, you know, she goes through all this, no, we just wanted to taste a little bit. And he just kept insisting and kept insisting. Well, what was happening there is none of these farmers pay any rent on that ground. All the ground that they're farming actually belongs to mommy and her family. Most of the homes that they live in actually belong to mommy and her family. And then, you know, the water situation, the drinking water is pretty much non-existent. We're working on a project to put a well in, and I still haven't finished it yet. The holes in the ground, blah, blah, blah. But they have to haul water, and on mommy's well actually pumps out of a cistern and fills a water tower. Well, you can't just let the water tower flow free, because it only replenished so fast. But since the community's been without water, a good supply of fresh water since the hurricane, every night they go down and turn on a valve that leads outside, and there's this line of people and children down the road to get drinking water. And they'll haul it in anything. It's kind of crazy to watch. Anything that hauls water comes up and down that road for hours. And they only run water for 2 or 3 hours every night. I think it's technically supposed to be 2 hours. You know, I hang out with the maintenance guy a lot, and he kind of fudges that. If there's somebody there to get water, he kind of, you know, he'll hang out there. And he cuts it off at some point just to keep people from taking advantage. And everybody kind of looks the other way that he does it, you know. That's one of the things I love about the Caribbean, is all the rules are literally more like guidelines. I tell you most of this story so that you understand the character behind the organization that I've partnered up with. They've adopted everybody. Anybody that shows up, You know, if you come to Lawndale and you find a piece of soil that's not being worked, and you think you can work it, you clear it, and you work it, and you harvest from it. And they don't ask for a thing from these people. You know, their own water supply is put at risk every day so that they can provide water for the community. They keep donating land. They donated the land that the clinic is built on right there. They donated the land that the school is built on. There was another church that was built, a church and a school, that the flood had washed out. And, you know, it just, the way it is. And they don't tolerate any unrest. You see, the people are, you know, I was actually safer than anybody really understands walking those streets. Not only because I'm American and, you know, they know where the help's coming from, but mostly because if you get caught fighting over water or get caught fighting over who's going to deal with what land, or if you get caught, you know, being a general pain in the neck, you get driven from the land. You don't get to partake. You're out. And I really like those guys. I mean, their way of doing life and my way of doing life are a lot the same. If each of us contributed more than we require, the whole thing grows. And then those that are incapable of contributing are provided for. And that's really the way they live their everyday life. And mostly, I don't think they have a choice, which is, I think, is where we often get in trouble. So we have a little bit too much choice. And we've bought this lie of independence. And we've bought all this that I can take care of myself and compromise the relationship. But what the orphanage is also a school. They provide school, I want to say free, but not entirely free. You got to remember the rules are more like guidelines. So, you know, if you're basically a contributor in the community, your kids can go to school. They notice that there's a high absence rate on Wednesday because it's market day. And when the parents were having to go down to market, the older kids had to miss school so that the kids could stay home with the littler kids and the parents could go on. And so they put in a daycare so that the parents could drop their kids off and the kids didn't have to miss school. I think the school takes, I don't know, the kind of numbers we're used to hearing, $40 or $50 a month to keep one kid in school, and they provide uniforms. They created a sewing manufacturing shop as part of a trade school program that we're putting together for adults to teach trades. So as part of their training tool, the sewing school actually makes the uniform and the clothing for the kids to come in. After they acquired another piece, I think it was shortly before the storm, actually, in another community, Kinskoff. And we've actually closed down the orphanage at Lawndale and moved all the kids to Kinskoff. Kinskoff's on the other side of the mountain. It's a little higher up the mountain, but it's a lot cooler. There's not the dust, and the health problems are easier to manage, other than the fact that you're now 2 hours from the nearest hospital, when we used to have a clinic, you know, right there at the orphanage. They're always overloaded. I mean, all the orphanages are always overloaded. The government in Haiti, and I think this is appropriate, maintains rights to 25% of their placement. So whatever their max capacity is, the government gets to place 25% of that. But they send kids and no money, because they figure that philanthropy needs to reside with the people. Taking care of philanthropy is the people's problem. It's the church's responsibility to do that. The government's overwhelmed as it is. And, you know, I think that's appropriate. I maintain that the worst thing to happen in this country was the advent of a welfare system. because then the church got to forget about them because the government's going to take care of them. And I maintain that we do just that. But, so, they have to understand orphans, right? The government's not going to take care of them, and it can't. But with this placement, this particular orphanage is known for taking the kids that nobody else wants or can handle. The last kid that came in that I remember was born water on her brain. Can't remember what that's called. Yeah, you guys got it. She's not gonna make it. I mean, it's difficult enough here to get an infant through this. So basically, they're just caring for her until she passes. Kids with physical disabilities, mental disabilities, you know, they take them, and they don't. No questions asked. They take them. And the president of the organization, Lucien, is actually mommy's son. And he's a really neat guy. Speaks great English. The first time I got to meet him, we were in his basement inspecting his water supply system and trying to figure out how to make a water pump work. Because the water pump up at Kinskoff had been struck by lightning and it was fried. So he pulled the pump out of his house to take to the orphanage to make sure the kids had water, and they hauled water back to his house to use from the orphanage for a couple of months while they got a new pump in. And then the pump that he's got's constantly throwing breakers, blah, blah, blah. It's a big pain in the neck. But that impressed me about this guy. You know, that he pulled his own pump to make sure that they were taken care of first. And then one of the babies, you know, he was the guy, personally. One of the babies needed to go to the emergency room and needed to go now. And he jumps in his car, 4 o'clock in the morning, and is headed down the mountain into Port-au-Prince. Yeah, that guy's some kind of weird Superman. And again, I just want to tell you the heartbeat of this organization, because you hear all kinds of crazy things about missions and how missions happen. And even the locals in Haiti, they have a bad attitude about missions, a lot of them, because they get the same impression. And a lot of this is spread by the local voodoo priests, you know, that the missionaries that come, they keep money for themselves so they can live good. And then just give just a little bit, just enough to stay legal to the people. And I personally have not experienced that, but I've only worked with the one organization. But I know that that's always our fear, is that that's the kind of things that take place. And so when I get to talk to people, and especially people that are local, you know, this is an organization that I've experienced, I'm on the ground with. I'm not there most of the time and come back here, you know, just to raise funds. I actually live right here in Kansas. I shoe horses for a living, and I do that because it provides a whole lot of freedom for me to do ministry. All my clients know what I do, so that when I manage to put enough money together to make a trip, we reschedule. I'm out for a week, and I take a group to Haiti, we do our thing and come back, and it's back to business as usual. So it's like having eyes on the ground. You know, we're always right there. And kind of the project that you guys have taken on is a little bit different for me. Because the way I like to do this is when I get people that say, hey, we want to go with you, I say, that's great. You need to put a group together. Because I am not a vacation planner. Okay, I am not a tour guide for Mercy Vacation and Mercy Tourism. Okay, if you're going to go with me, we're going to work. And we're going to follow the Lord's leading. And what I do is say, look, you need to get two or three of your buddies together, and we'll all get together. And you guys inquire of the Lord and see how much of a project he wants us to do. And it's going to cost at least $2,000 a person just to get there and back and provide for your meals. And that's a little bit more than it actually takes. Blah, blah, blah. We can get into that if you ever want to hear about it. And then I tell them, now, how much of a project are you going to do? Oh, well, what are we going to do? Well, I don't know what we're going to do yet. We're Gideonites, man. We just move to the next thing. And then we let God figure it out from there. So you guys figure out how much of a project does God want you to do. I like to use $10,000 as a nice round number because it doesn't seem like you can do anything with less than $10,000 anywhere. And so we'll train together and meet once a week, once a month. Just depends on kind of the nature of things while they raise their money. And then once that money is put together, I'd call the organization, hey, we got 10 guys that know how to do this and $10,000. What do you need? And you know, it sounds pretty simple, but people don't get excited about that. It's weird. You know, I've managed to pull off one trip like that in 2 years. It's just weird. Everybody wants, they want pictures and faces and what are we doing? And how much do we need? And how is it held accountable? And how do we know that's actually what's going to happen? And blah, 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 blah. And it's like, wow. If you can't smell the worldly wisdom in that, I don't know who can. And now comes the part when I come with a warning label. You know, or then I get the people that come and comment and say, man, I'd like to do what you're doing. I just haven't gotten there yet. And I'm going to tell you right now, if you haven't gotten there yet, you haven't gotten there at all. Because faith without works is dead. Period. We don't work our way to heaven. But if we know the grace and mercy of Christ, we can't help going to work. You're going to do it. So if you haven't gotten there yet, that's cool. You're hearing the call. We all have to start somewhere. I was in church my whole life and got there in 2007 when I realized that I wasn't called to be a consumer and sit in a pew and get my weekly dose of feel good. That I was called to live my life, all of it, in the service to something else. So if you're not there yet, that's cool. You just need to understand, if you're not there yet, you're not there at all. And so, like I say, I'm not here to talk you into jumping into my calling. You know, I'm here to invite you, find yours. And if what we're doing is cool, then come and help us. And I forgot to bring up the washer and dryer. We're the project that you guys have taken on is a washer and dryer for a commercial washer and dryer for the orphanage. Okay, they've bought several washer and dryers in country. They always break down. 70 kids that they're doing laundry for and can't keep up. And last time I was there, those women are hand washing cloth diapers. Get your attention right there, don't you? And so I was like, okay, we'll figure out how to get you guys a commercial washer and dryer. I can't remember what we set the goal at because honestly, I couldn't get an honest bid on the freight. Because not only we got to get this thing bought, we got to get it there. And that's a lot harder than you might think. So that's really what you guys are working towards. And I just wanted to use my time to let you know. I mean, when you think about, well, okay, so we're going to work to buy a washer and dryer. It seems, frivolous, but it seems like extra compared to needing fresh water. But when you have those many kids and the kids with those disabilities, and you've got your staff constantly washing dirty diapers, they're not holding and playing with babies. And then babies being held and played with, that's a big priority for me. So I'm going to pray and give it back to somebody. I've kept you long enough, and then we'll move on. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to come and share the story of what you're doing with Village of Vision in Haiti. And just thank you for these people to answer your call and invite me here to share that. And I pray that anything that I had to say that wasn't glorifying to you or leading people in the right direction that just fall away as a chaff, Father. And I pray that you bless this mission that we're on and bless this goal that they've set to help us out in Haiti. And you put your hand on it so that we might achieve it and achieve it with a glad heart. In Jesus' name, amen.